and ask you to do one thing. As we came into the room, we had these chairs set up this way. We didn't have a chance to move them more into a semicircle. So let's move the chairs around so Jim can be, Jim McDonald, our speaker, can be more in the middle of a circle rather than, semi-horseshoe. So let's make more of a circle so we can see each other's faces and be ready for more of a community dialogue than an lecture. Although Jim...
So we sort of move some chairs and bring all circle together, right?
Yeah. We usually get in here a little earlier, but there was another group meeting in here just until 3 o'clock, so as the door opened, we started getting in and started sitting down and then do our circle. So, my name is Frank Lukowski. I'm a member of Occupy Helena, and I'm a member of a work group of Occupy Helena called the Community Connections Work Group, which has been doing a variety of dialogue events since December. Occupy Helena has been in existence since October 15th, when we joined the national movement in support of Occupy Wall Street. This particular event today is the third in a series that we began back on February 26th, called the Occupy Helena Community Dialogue Series. And last time we had Donna Peterson of Helena, who may be here yet later today, to talk about her struggles against Bank of America, which was carrying on a whole series of outrageous actions and then trying to foreclose on her house. And she described that process, and we had a dialogue about that. The good news was that the day before they were to go to court to require Bank of America to cease and desist, Bank of America decided to stipulate that she was not going to have her house foreclosed upon without making any agreement that they had done anything wrong. So that was the good news. But in our series, then, we've been dialoguing about issues related to Wall Street and the banks of Wall Street and the issues concerning the greed and the activities of Wall Street corporations, multinational corporations, and how they've affected so many in the United States, leading, of course, to the tremendous suffering that began in September 2008, top of all the current suffering before then, that led to the loss of 30 million jobs. There's still millions of people out of work right now as a result of the wheeler-dealer activities of these people. So as part of the series then today, we have Jim McDonald, who's here from Occupy Bozeman, along with some of the other folks from Occupy Bozeman, to talk about a campaign that they have initiated in Bozeman to help encourage the investment of funds from Wells Fargo Bank. I'm very appreciative that Jim came over. He's even got Sun River here as part of the dialogue. So it's very, very nice to have you here. Jim has been one of the main persons in the Occupy Bozeman movement, but he's been involved in peace and justice and environmental activities for a long, long time. He moved to the Bozeman area at the end of 2007, and he co-founded Buffalo Allies of Bozeman in 2008, which used consensus-based principles for organizing around protecting the buffalo and that in Montana. 2010-2011, he spent the entire season volunteering with the Buffalo Field Campaign. And then in 2011, and if you haven't visited the Northern Rockies independent media site for their activities, you should. He is one of the people who's deeply involved in that. He joined that effort, which is an open publishing site for people of all persuasions who would like to spread the word about their activities or share dialogue with others. So he's been involved in that. And then since that time, when he got involved with Northern Rockies Independent Media Collective. He's been involved with Occupy Bozeman and has helped organize several actions, in particular its Wells Fargo divestment campaign. He writes a lot on the blogs, which is great because there's a person who does his homework and researches and is smart as heck, as far as I can tell. And he dialogues with folks online in response to their questions and concerns. So you can find that at the Occupy Bozeman site, occupybozeman.org, or at the Northern Rockies Independent Media website. Prior to moving to Bozeman, he lived in the Washington, D.C. area for years and was heavily involved in anti-war and global justice organizing at the grassroots level there. And one interesting thing I did find out in the last couple of days was that he was involved as the point person for a 15,000-person rally organized on a very small budget protesting George Bush's inaugural by having a counter-inaugural. So I want to congratulate him for that. He's been involved at all levels of the anti-war movement from the regional to the national level. Without saying anything more, I'd like to just introduce again and give the floor to Jim McDonald of Occupy Bozeman.
Okay. Thank you. And if you don't mind, I'm actually recording this, this will probably appear on the Rocky Mountain Independent Media Network, which is rockymt.org. And certainly would love people in Helena not to share what you're doing here in terms of Occupy, but whatever you want. It's not just news, it's cultural. If you have poetry, if you have pictures, art, philosophy, feel free to post it there. You don't need a user account. Just a plug for my other group. I'm going to pass out some stuff. The first thing here is I'm passing out stuff in part because I'm not going to cover every in and out of why you should not have money in Wells Fargo, figuring this is a pretty friendly crowd. And I want to go a different direction with the talk. But this flyer here was put together by a group in Virginia called Blue Ridge Peace Action. They actually used the Occupy Bozeman materials in part for their research. And so there's a connection across the country that we've already made from our work. And they've put together this great flyer, Wells Fargo Facts You Need to Know. And so I'm just going to pass this out. And the other thing I'm going to pass out is a series of writings, a lot of them by me, one of them by Josh Davis here. He wrote a satirical love letter to Wells Fargo. But this has our call to action. There's an article write-up of one of our actions early on, even before there was a campaign, that has some facts. Also, I wrote an article on many reasons why you should divest. I also have a frequently asked questions section. And then an article I wrote more recently on what I think's at stake, which will somewhat be the theme, Wells Fargo and the Loss of Our Voices, One Anarchist View. And I do identify as an anarchist. That's from my point of view, not necessarily representing Occupy Bozeman, but me in that case, because we're a diverse group of people. So let me pass these out and read them at your leisure. You obviously won't be able to read them all while I'm talking. So I just want to give a little background about Occupy Bozeman and how we got to the point of having a campaign against Wells Fargo, and why Wells Fargo and not some other bank, like, for instance, Bank of America, which I know has played a part with the foreclosures here in Helena. Occupy Bozeman definitely got something of a slow start, I think, in regards to the rest of the Occupy movement. There was never an encampment. There weren't a lot of protests. What ultimately happened and how it got started was there were some college students at Montana State University who said, hey, there's no Occupy movement here, let's start something. And they spontaneously organized in a very short amount of time, within a couple weeks, in mid-October, a march and rally that attracted about 200 people. And that was really great and beautiful, and it brought a large section of the community together, and there was a big rally in front of our library, and people felt very positive. But what happened immediately after that was nothing happened immediately after that. The students who ran things said next steps will be coming soon, and they didn't come. And a lot of us in the community were wondering, wait a second, the Occupy movement was about no leaders, you know, everybody together. Who are these students telling us, when are they going to act? When is something going to happen? So eventually, with enough community pressure, the students said, okay, let's have an open community meeting. And we did sometime in, I believe it was a few weeks later in November, and there were over 40 people who showed up. But not having a real good sense of process, people not knowing each other, it was kind of a lot of people, which was exciting, but it was a mess. The students became somewhat disgruntled because they didn't necessarily want the consensus process, interestingly enough, and it developed a rift in our community between students and community, a rift that kind of still exists. Actually, students, it's not so much a rift, the students just stopped doing it. But the problem was the students over that time had started developing website, Facebook page, a lot of stuff, but they were no longer involved with the group. The community group, which was now shrinking to, now 15, 20, 10, 15, 20 people, now wanted to be able to organize, and we spent the next month trying to get our communications together, trying to figure out our internal processes, how to get access to the Facebook, the Twitter accounts, developing a website. And that took a while, and the group almost disappeared during that time because nobody was getting the word about anything. So things got really slow, but eventually we got access to the Facebook, and we got access to the Twitter, and we got more stability in our meetings, and we again kind of grew. But not having a good sense of how to deal with that, we shrunk a little bit. And so it was in that environment of growth and shrinking, that I was thinking, well, what can we be doing? We need to do something. We were doing little actions here and there, but we need to do something that feels like it's in the spirit of Occupy. I mean, we didn't have an encampment, but what was the encampment about? The encampment was supposed to be a direct assault at the 1%, at those who are creating the conditions of economic disparity. So I thought, well, what if we had a constant presence of some sort in front of like one of the big banks in town? And in Bozeman, there are really only two big national banks, Wells Fargo and U.S. Bank. And so I thought, well, why don't I just raise this to the group at one of our smaller meetings? And there was some excitement about that. The thinking was, here's some space that we're somewhat occupying, and we're also doing something to go after one of what we took in theory to be one of the big problems in our society, the power the big banks have over us. And so that's how it got started. And we had to decide, U.S. Bank or Wells Fargo. And one big argument for U.S. Bank is Montana State University has their accounts at U.S. Bank. But in our research and the group that was there, we found just so many more egregious things going on at Wells Fargo that we thought it might be easier to do the research for a campaign at Wells Fargo. And of course, there was some discussion in the group. The idea was that we needed to focus. If we didn't focus, we would just be scattered to the wind and get nothing done. So that was why we chose to focus on one bank. So then it was a matter of writing a call to action. But even that wasn't simple because there was an argument in our group. Do we tell people to take their money out of Wells Fargo and put them into any local institution or just credit unions or small local banks okay. And we argued about that, and we ultimately had no consensus, so we just sort of broadly said local institution. But we eventually got somewhat going, and we started doing research, and I started doing research, and a lot of that research is either in the packet of stuff I gave you or pointed to from that packet. If you go to the online stuff, it's a lot easier to find where I'm getting the information from, because I don't actually put my sources in quotes. I have direct links, and that's why it's easier to see online. But the idea was Wells Fargo is this big, overwhelming presence that's clearly doing great damage. And it turns out, you know, we didn't know anything. We knew the big banks were a problem, but it turns out Wells Fargo is the fourth largest bank in the country and the nation's leading mortgage lender. Well, obviously, you know, that was something that you needed to go after, because the mortgage crisis precipitated what happened. And the theory behind the campaign is if you get the money out of the banks and you do have that money more locally, then we have more local control over that, and therefore we have more voice and more power and more ability to deal with injustices, so that big things don't just happen tear us apart. So that's a little bit of it. And it turns out big banks have higher fees than smaller banks and credit unions. And big banks have higher interest rates than smaller banks and credit unions. And you have no say, ultimately, when you make an investment, where that money goes. But if you are a member in a credit union, theoretically at least, you are part of the decision making. You have some say in the governance of that institution. Big banks are more likely to spend the money elsewhere. Smaller institutions, credit unions, are more likely to keep it at home. And then there are other things about Wells Fargo we discovered, like they have a $120 million ownership stake in two private prison corporations. One of them, the Corrections Corporation of America, actually helped co-write SB 1070 in Arizona, which is the anti-immigration law. So it was like, whoa, you know. So you give money to Wells Fargo, and they're using it to privatize the prison industry. And we also know in Montana what that's done in some communities, where you have a financed prison that's just sitting empty. Where there's an incentive to put people in jail for profit. And so that was interesting, that Wells Fargo does not give mortgages to homes that are that could be leased for natural gas fracking. But they also they're also big financers of natural gas fracking companies. So you get money and you don't know where it's going to go. It also goes to environmental causes too. It goes all over the place, but you don't have any say. The fact that a big corporation like Wells Fargo, because it's responsible to shareholders, just takes all this money off the top and gives it to their biggest shareholders and investors, but they can screw you over in the process, and we've seen that over and over. So. Obviously, if you could do something to hurt that bank locally, then maybe you could make a difference. Maybe you could inspire other communities to be doing the same thing. I mean, that's the theory behind it. Here's a pillar of the problem. Hurt that pillar. Move it somewhere else that's more helpful, and something good happens. And the fact is, these sorts of divestment campaigns have worked in other fields. The most famous is, I don't know if anybody here is aware of Huntington Life Sciences. Has anyone heard of that? Huntington Life Sciences is a British company that is notorious for its animal testing. Well, whatever you feel about animal testing, those who oppose that, and they have, they also have an American subsidiary, formed a group called Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty, or SHAC, and they engage in a divestment campaign with many facets, very controversial. But SHAC was successful through its various tactics of getting Huntington Life Sciences stock to fall down so low that it was no longer listed in the New York Stock Exchange. So very effective actions. And there's no reason why we couldn't do that with a bank, particularly since we do have one point of leverage on a bank. A bank never has as much money as it's created to give out. So if you make a, you know, why bank runs are illegal, if everyone suddenly takes their money out of a bank topples in that sense more easily than some other institutions. Say, if you boycotted Coca-Cola, you know, which there is a big worldwide call for a boycott of Coca-Cola because of their labor practices in Colombia and water practices in India. It's not the same. You stop buying Coca-Cola, all they're hurt is your purchase. You take money out of your bank, it's hurt more because they're over-leveraged beyond that. So that was the thinking. But, you know, am I going to tell you the truth that we're being really successful? No. I mean, Wells Fargo is strong. We've had a couple protests outside of the bank. Didn't develop into a regular picket, which was the idea. It's really hard to get energy, you know, going. We still have meetings that range anywhere from 7 to 11 people at a typical Occupy Bozeman meeting. So we're working on it, but I sense what's really happening is that there's a great sense of disempowerment. And I think this is directly related to what banks do to us. And that's sort of the focus of where I want to bring this to. Because banks are so strong, because banks have become too big to fail, whether it's Wells Fargo or Bank of America or Citigroup or Chase, they've become so large that if they fail, and the government doesn't rescue them, the whole economy collapses. Because banks know this, they have incredible say over our lives. And it's worse than that because none of them are elected, right? So we don't have any real power against the banks. And yet they're destroying us. We've seen how fraudulent activities can almost drive somebody out of their house here in Helena, you know? And this is happening all over the country. But what can you do? If you raise a fuss against the bank and the bank starts going under, the government just steps in and has to bail them out because everything is tied together. And so there's this incredible radical disempowerment. And you can say, well, let's vote somebody else in. But if you vote somebody else in, they're doing the same thing. You know, Bush was for the bailout, Obama was for the bailout. Whoever comes in is going to be for bailout. And if they're not for bailout, well, what happens? Everything collapses. And who gets hurt? The poor, right? And so we're in a sense of being stuck, a sense of radical disempowerment, where our voices really don't matter. And I think that's the feeling that goes on in a place like Bozeman about Wells Fargo, that we don't feel we can take action in any meaningful way that will actually bring about a difference. But the longer we do that, the more this problem perpetuates itself. And so we need to find ways. And I think a divestment campaign where you are telling people, don't just take your money out of the system, but put it back into some local means, is a way, if things did suddenly crash, that you would still have some local economy, more empowerment at the local level in which to act. You would suddenly have more voice, more sense that what you do matters. But ultimately, You know, what does it take? How do we get there? How do we convince people that this makes sense? That you need to take action. If it's not in banking, it's something else. That we have the confidence of our convictions to move forward. And I guess that's ultimately where I want to drive the discussion, not why Wells Fargo, what is so bad about Wells Fargo, how does that compare to Bank of America? You know, who cares? You know, it's obviously a huge problem all the way around, and the real problem is us. How are we going to react to that? How are we going to feel like we can take action and matter and have a voice and take actions which help restore the voice for everybody else so that the obvious disenchantment that people understandably feel becomes, suddenly has an outlet where suddenly they matter. I mean, what's nice is that we're in a small group and we can speak to each other. How do we create a society where our speaking to each other matters? Because right now, they don't care. They don't care that we're here. They don't care that we're talking. That's why they let us talk. We can talk because they're still making huge amounts of money because too many of us are still invested in those banks. Too many of us are still invested in a system with nowhere to go. We have to give them reason to worry about us, to think that we can hurt them and that we're doing so in a way that's actually helping ourselves and helping our communities, not just helping ourselves in a selfish way, but helping each other. And that's why in that light, in that sense of not me just preaching to you, I want to invite one of our members of our group who is working on an alternative, who is trying to think of the transitional ways that we can take power away from the big banks and bring it closer to home. Josh here has been working on an initiative called the Public Banking Institute, which is an idea to bring, it's sort of like the central bank, but it's the central bank at the state level. It's something they've been doing in North Dakota. And in the spirit of empowerment, of not me just saying, be empowered, but to actually share it, I want to, in that vein, invite Josh to speak and then to open up the discussion to give you an example of something somebody is doing to help us out of this malaise.
Thanks, Jim. My name's Josh Davis. I've been living in Missoula for about the last 12 years and just recently moved to Bozeman. And was involved with the Occupy group over in Missoula before I moved. And a number of us, in conversations with other occupiers, were interested in the banking system and alternative banking systems. And as I kind of started looking more into that, I became aware of this idea of public banking. Which is something, as Jim said, that the state of North Dakota has been aware of and has been making good use of for almost 100 years now, since 1919. They have a model there that a lot of people across the country are now looking at as and wanting to replicate in their own state. Got involved in this campaign. It turned out there were already other people working in this vein and towards the same kind of goal, and so I got hooked up with them through the Public Banking Institute, which is a nonpartisan think tank out of Sedona, I believe, California, and they've only been around for about a year and a half, and just dedicated to trying to help states create their own state banks, their own public banks. The basic idea behind the state bank is that, all right, our state collects taxes and fees, and where does all that money go right now? Well, I hadn't really even thought about it. Most people don't, I think about it. They think, oh, I pay my state taxes, and that goes to the state, and they must have a room somewhere where they keep them all or something. But no, what actually happens is the state of Montana has an account at U.S. Bank, just like you or I would have an account only this account that the state has is much, much larger, of course. And so all of the financial transactions that our state does right now basically goes through U.S. Bank. There are various state agencies that have their own accounts at different local institutions and some, you know, at big banks around the state. But for the most part, we have a big account at U.S. Bank here in Helena. The idea is that rather than having the state, you know, deposit all of this money with U.S. Bank, that the state would have its own bank, and that the fees and the taxes, rather than becoming a deposit for U.S. Bank, would be a deposit at the public bank. And then once you've got, you know, this public bank, you can do like they've done in North Dakota, which is you can determine on the basis of wanting to promote economic development or, you know, standard of living in your state, you can determine who you want to give loans to and what kind of loan programs you want to offer. Is really kind of the payoff of having a state bank. And so in North Dakota, what they have is they have loan programs for agriculture. They have loan programs for students, for the higher education. They have loan programs for small businesses, and they also do some mortgage loan kind of programs. What this does is basically make credit available to businesses in the state of North Dakota that might not otherwise be available, to businesses, to ag folks, to students, and at lower interest rates, more affordable credit. As we saw in 2008, our economy requires credit, and it requires the flow of credit to be able to keep operating smoothly. And when that system seizes up, it has cascading effects, and we feel it down on Main Street as well. And so what part of what a public bank allows is is kind of puts a buffer between your state and the independent local banks in the state and that larger national credit system. There was a conference call just this last Friday that included the president of the Bank of North Dakota, the head of the North Dakota Bankers Association, and a couple of presidents from independent banks in North Dakota that partner with the Bank of North Dakota. And that was one thing that they kept kind of pressing home, was that credit crunch in 2008 did not hit North Dakota at all, because they have a public bank that partners with the local institutions. So how the Bank of North Dakota works, like I said, they have all of their state money is deposited in their own bank that they run, and then they have loan programs. The way these loan programs work is they partner with local banks and credit unions to provide loans. So for instance, the small business loans, this Bank of North Dakota will provide, say, a backstop, a guarantee on a small business loan, maybe for a business that might be a little bit riskier than the bank would normally be willing to make a loan for, you know, loan, or maybe that's too large. So basically the state bank is helping the independent local banks to offer more services, to offer specific loan programs to make sure that, you know, that there's adequate supplies of credit, I guess, in the North Dakota economy. So it's basically just, the idea is that we're going to take our state money and we're going to make sure it's used to create economic development in Montana, rather than taking all of the state money, giving it to U.S. Bank, and letting them, you know, make loans to whoever for whatever, wherever they feel like. So, you know, there are a number of conceivable benefits to to having a state bank, like I said, one of the major ones, I think, is really this kind of insulation from the really screwed up national banking system that we have. And that seems to be what North Dakota, as they were kind of insulated from all of that. Having some more control over what our money, our state money, is going to be used for.
I want color.
Anybody have a question? I didn't really prepare too much, sorry.
I think you've both done a great job, a terrific job. I was just wondering if maybe the reason why there aren't more state banks and more government banks is that it's such a huge source of political campaign funding, and that by privatizing banks, then they can fund the political campaigns. If you have a state bank, then don't politicians maybe can get contributions from a state bank for political campaigns?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's the state bank itself in North Dakota, the only model, I guess, or example that we have, they're not going out and making campaign contributions, you know, as a bank, for obvious reasons. That would just be as strange as the, you know, Fish and Game Department making a big contribution to some gubernatorial candidate. Wouldn't make any sense. So definitely the people who have, or the interests that are opposed to this whole idea of states having their own banks, are the big multinational banks, the Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Bank of America, these folks, because right now they have kind of, they have a monopoly, they have an oligopoly on this market. They have, you know, Montana is a fairly small state. Our ending balance in 2010, I just looked, it was like $250 million or something. Not a real huge amount of money, but if you think about a state like California, California is in the same situation we are. Their state funds are going into, I don't know, probably Bank of America or Wells Fargo, an account at one of these banks. Huge, huge amount of money. And so obviously, you know, U.S. Bank of Montana or whoever, California or the other states are banking with, it definitely has an interest in making sure they don't lose that those huge deposits. And, you know, up till recently, it seemed like there wasn't, you know, what's the big deal? Why not, you know, use Bank of America or have Wells Fargo? You know, they're sound, you know, institutions, but it's become quite clear that they're not at all sound institutions. They're rife with a lot of fraud, and that hasn't been adequately dealt with on the national level. And so I think that, you know, it might be a little more apparent now why we would want to have our own bank. Even if the private banks, even if the big multinationals were operating in a totally legitimate manner, it would still be a good idea for us to have our own bank so that we can, you know, have some control over, you know, what our deposits are being leveraged to fund. But, you know, given the case that we have now, it's even more, it's an even better idea to not have to do business with what we've discovered are pretty fraudulent, corrupt businesses. So like I said, there's right now Hawaii is there, right, currently considering state bank legislation. Oregon, they were looking at their last legislative session. It'll be coming up again in their next one, I guess. There are about a dozen states that have some, you know, that are looking at, you know, creating a state bank in one form or another. It's really the only people that are not going to benefit are the big major banks, the big multinationals now. If the state banks are run along a partnership kind of model like North Dakota is, it's going to make local banks a lot more competitive. They'll come out net winners for sure. this kind of system.
I would like to pick up, though, on your point about elections. And, I mean, yeah, Wells Fargo spends, you can go to opensecrets.org and see what kind of money they're spending on political campaigns. They've spent more money on lobbyists and lobbying in the last year than I think they ever have. They also are, I think the big issue is they're not accountable. You know, they were a party to the deal along with Bank of America and the other big banks on the fraudulent foreclosures, which came to, I think Wells Fargo's share came to $2 billion, $3 billion, which is simply one quarter of their net profits. They'd already accounted for it. They've been fined millions in settlements, but it's nothing. They made $15 billion, not in gross profits, but net profits last year alone. So, you know, how do you take this on using the political system when they already have so much control over it and are not accountable? And so trying to decentralize that, state banks, credit unions, obviously, I don't know what else to do, and it's a hard fight, but I don't know what else we can do. You know?
And it would be the legislature probably that would have to establish a state bank?
Right, so the kind of our campaign that myself and really Sheena Rice and Molly Moody with the Montana Organizing Project, which is a coalition group of labor and progressive religious organizations in the state. The campaign is for to present legislation in the 2013 session to create a state bank. If we can't get it through the legislature, then we would consider taking it to an initiative. Basically, just because of speed and perceived ease of actually getting something passed, we're going the legislative route first. There were two bills in the last legislative session, one that would have created the state bank that was introduced by Joe Reed, who is a Tea Party Republican. The other one was a bill that would set up a study commission to look at a state bank, and that was introduced by a progressive Democrat. We don't want a study commission bill. There's a couple of states that are looking at that. We don't think that's really necessary. So we're going to have some progressive Democrat, I would imagine, is going to submit legislation in 2013 to start a bank. If this is really apropos to what you were asking or not, but one of the concerns has been that, like, okay, well, you know, you're going to have this big bank and it's going to be run by politicians, and of course that's going to be, you know, just, you know, ripe for corruption, and you know, you're going to, you know, you don't want this financial institution being, you know, jerked around by politics. And yeah, that's, you know, maybe a concern, but as we, the way that we that it's set up in North Dakota is, you know, you have the governor and the head of the Department of Labor and Industry and somebody else, like the head of the banking regulatory agency, are on an oversight board that kind of just makes sure that the bank is doing, you know, what they think it needs to be done. But the actual day-to-day operations are being done by people who are professional bankers, with one big difference between the state bankers and the big private bankers is they're being paid a salary. They get the same regardless of how many loans they make, and you know, their goal is to benefit the state and the people of the state. Their goal is not to benefit their stockbrokers and themselves, or their stockholders and themselves. And with the big banks, we've seen mostly it's about benefiting the executives, not even the stockholders so much. So, just rambling.
So, is the ownership model for the public bank that the state and thereby the citizens of the state are the owners?
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways that it could go, and we haven't really talked enough with people to find out what kind of model we're going to suggest. The way North Dakota does it is it's the Bank of North Dakota is the state of North Dakota doing business as the Bank of North Dakota, which means that the whole, everything, all the state land is also an asset of the state, or of the bank, rather.
Of the bank.
Of the bank. And so, I mean, so this is an interesting idea in that, wow, all of a sudden, you know, you can, you know, the state of Montana owns a lot of property, it's got a lot of value, you could have a really big bank really quickly. There are some reasons why you might not want to do that, and rather have the, there be a separate agency basically kind of set up within the state, I guess, that would own the bank, and that would run the bank, so, you know, put some separation in there. But it would be, it would have as much, we'd have as much democratic control over the, over a state bank as we have over the rest of our state, you know, legislature at this point. It's, so.
Are they insured by the FDIC?
No, that's one interesting thing with the Bank of North Dakota is that the state insures all of the deposits at the state bank, which this Bank of North Dakota doesn't really take private accounts. Like I couldn't go if I lived in North Dakota and just open up an account with the state bank. Municipalities have accounts with the state bank. The state, of course, has their own, you know, account at the state bank. And the state itself provides the insurance for those. The FDIC insurance, so there's a couple of things. One, it allows the banks that are partnered with the Bank of North Dakota, they don't have to, they don't have all the regulations that FDIC banks normally would. I mean, they still, their safety and soundness regulations, but, and I don't know enough about the ins and outs of the banking system to know exactly what's going on, but apparently there are some definite benefits to banks of not having to abide by all of the FDIC regulations that don't necessarily make the bank any less stable, but, you know, provide some advantages. For the bank, for North Dakota itself, and the same goes for Montana, FDIC insurance for Montana means essentially nothing because FDIC insurance is up to $250,000. Well, what's our account at, you know, the, at U.S. Bank at $250 million? So if we have to rely on FDIC insurance for the state, it does us no good. We get $250,000 back and we can all, I guess, divide it up. So, it, you know, the state doesn't really make any difference whether the state is has FDIC insurance
or
not.
So people can't put their money in it?
No. Yeah, for the most part, that's there are some exceptions. I think like 5% of their accounts are private, personal type accounts for whatever reason. But yeah, the vast majority is just state money and then just municipalities having their accounts there. Which is one thing in Montana. All of our, you know, city and county governments also have bank accounts with, you know, U.S. Bank or Wells Fargo, whoever they're banking with right now, for the most part, because only the large banks can provide all the services that are that the municipalities need. However, if we had a state bank like North Dakota, that's where the municipalities do their banking. And so, you know, setting up a state bank would definitely, I mean, there's, it would amount to a large divestment campaign. And kind of, you know, by other means, that's not necessarily the spin that we're trying to put on it, but that's definitely one thing that would happen is we would take a lot of money out of the private banking, not out of the private banking system per se, but just away from these particular banks, the big multinationals, and yeah, make it available to local.
Well, it's private accounts, but it's our money. It's public money.
It's public money that right now is just being placed in private hands. And they can do whatsoever they will with it.
Do you remember the bill number in the last session, Joe Reed's number?
No, it was 11 something, I think.
He was the sponsor?
Joe Reed was the sponsor of one. Both of those bills died in committee with pretty even bipartisan support and what's the opposite of support?
Opposition.
Opposition, yes. So
when you say bulk bills, the second bill had to do with the study commission?
Yeah, it would.
Interim commission?
Yeah, it would create a study commission to look at different options for creating a state bank and whether or not it would be a good idea.
Okay, and if I went to this NorthDakota.gov and searched for the public bank, I would find it.
Yeah, if you just do a Google search for Bank of North Dakota, which is the BND, that's their, they come up with their website and they'll tell you everything you ever wanted to know about how their bank operates.
Did you get the impression that Reed's bill had any, what you might call, intellectual substance behind it, or was it more like a resolution?
No, Reed's bill did have some substance behind it. It had a lot of problems. As well. It didn't, like, I think that what we want to do is you know, our bill should be fairly cut and dry. You know, we don't, like, his, it was like 60 pages or something ridiculous, and he had a whole bunch of, like, changing how the money in the Colt Trust was used, which that's obviously going to be a non-starter and raise up, you know, all kinds of hackles. And then, There were a lot of things that were in the bill that didn't necessarily have to do directly with creating a state bank. That I was reading, like, why are you putting this in here? Why are you even talking about it? You know, it seems to be an unrelated issue, and maybe it's just some pet issue of yours that you just kind of decided to throw in there. I think it was pretty flawed bill. Like, I'm kind of glad it didn't pass, and that's not, you know, the version of the state bank that we got. He had a really dumb name for it, too. He wanted to call it the Last Chance Bank of Montana. It just sounds bad. I know.
Sounds good for Helen.
Definitely Helen-centric, but... but, yeah, so
it had a lot of issues. I know we have our investment board, which I think invests. Now, what money is that?
Right, and I was, actually my father came by earlier to drop off a pair of shoes I left at his house last weekend, and he was asking me about a similar question, like, so what,
how,
so I'm not sure exactly on how the Board of Investments interacts with the Treasury guys and how that all works, but it's my guess would be that it wouldn't change very much. I mean,
what I'm trying to get at is, I was going to ask about pension funds, because that's like California. They would have huge cloud if they chose a different bank, or if they chose a different investment bank to invest their money. And I think that part of where, you know, I'm not sure, maybe those teachers and retirement investment funds from the state may be part of it, or investments is in charge of.
Right, I would imagine that that's...
So our question, what's the connection between pension funds and those monies being invested versus this idea of public bank?
Well, I think it's pretty much a separate issue. This is all just kind of my understanding. Like, I have a bachelor's degree in economics, but that doesn't really... Like, I just kind of read about the stuff on the internet. So the pension fund investments that's money that's invested. That's not money that's sitting in a state bank account. Our pension funds here in Montana, like pension funds all over the country, have been totally screwed by the banks, and we're sold a bunch of shoddy, you know, fraudulent products, and now it looks like investors, mostly pension funds, are going to end up paying for this mortgage settlement, since it looks like their banks are going to be writing down first liens before their second liens. And if anybody's following that, it's kind of crazy. But it looks like the pension funds are going to get even more screwed with this settlement than they already have been. But I don't know that there's really a whole lot of overlap. Like, it's not going to change. Like, I don't think the Board of Investments has probably been doing that great of a job. If pension funds have lost a whole bunch of money, I think they'll still be able to do that.
I think the reason why this bill didn't have the Colt Trust money is, I think whether it's renewable energy or, you know, beginning farmers, it's often where people come up with an idea, let's get that money that's in that fund and use it for good public purpose.
Yeah.
So that debate and that attempt, you know, happens a lot, and that may be part of why he went there.
Yeah.
It's a favorite place people go.
Yeah, so capitalizing the bank is another thing, is one of the major issues that we've been discussing. And there are, again, a couple of different ways that you can capitalize the bank. One, like, you can just make the bank a DBA of your state. You could also do a bond issue. You could take money from the general fund and just use money from the general fund to create, you know, to capitalize a bank. You could do that. Probably, I think the best idea would be to have a bond issue, $60 million or whatever, depending on what size of bank we want to have, to raise the capital for the bank, and then the bank itself, just through the operation of the bank, can repay that bond. That's the other thing I should mention with a state-owned bank, is that the state bank is making loans to people through their partner institutions. When those loans are paid back with interest, that's now revenue for the state. That's going into the state bank. And in North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota has returned about over $300 million in the last decade to the state general fund. So just kind of like the Federal Reserve, you know, gives their profits to Treasury and keeps them, you know, for themselves to keep running their bank, the state bank does the same thing. They, you know, keep whatever they need for operating expenses, and the rest of the whatever profit they're making goes back to the state, which then, that's great. The state can have more programs or not have to cut programs or, you know, cut taxes or something like that.
I just Googled it. State Bank, there's all kinds of stuff. Even
oh yeah, their website's great, and they really, I mean, they go into history.
Recent articles about it. And
yeah.
I think it said that they have about $5 billion assets, so they're doing a lot with even a small asset base.
Yeah, I mean, there's only 600,000 people in North Dakota. I mean, this is even smaller than Montana, and yeah, they've... Yes, I mean, yeah, there is a lot you can do, and I mean, that's the thing, when you own a bank, you can make money out of nothing. You know, you can, and so, let's go.
I like the idea of the state bank, but even if we set up a state bank and then got some of the funds that are now placed in there from our state or Montana accounts into Bank of U.S. Bank or WIRB, there would still be the issue of all the money that Wells Fargo and Bank of America, First Interstate Bank and others, some of them are better than others, but still, that's not going into locally controlled, democratically controlled organizations. So I think that we wouldn't want to put all of our, I mean, Wells Fargo campaign, I think, appeals to me because in addition to this, which raises issues about how public tax funds are not under the control of the people, there's still all these funds that we each control that Wells Fargo is using in ways that I would not want them to use if I had money with them rather than credit unions. But I think that if you go down, that we still need to divest from Bank of America and Wells Fargo, because if you go down the street or do a survey, I think you can find out that people don't know how bad Bank of America and Wells Fargo are. That they would be shocked to learn that Wells Fargo just charges higher rates to poor people.
Right.
I mean, it's a criminal type of activity, ethically. Maybe not criminal, but probably legal, but it's unethical to be doing these kinds of things. So I'm going to say that in addition to this track for the creation of the state bank, that we need to continue these investment campaigns, and then maybe work with Public Citizen or other organizations trying to break up Bank of America. It's too big to fail, therefore let's break it up. Because it's too large and has too much impact if it fails. So we need to break it up, not to say, well, there's nothing we can do. Just bail them up, break them up, which is what Public Citizen is talking about. I think at least those three actions are parallel.
Yeah, for sure. And what, you know, Jim's been doing and the other Occupy folks with the divestment campaign and what I've been doing with the public bank, kind of two separate...
But they're all important.
Yeah. Related but separate campaigns going on. They're definitely both important, I think. And interesting, you mentioned breaking up the too big to fail institutions. The Dallas Fed just came out with a report saying that they're the too big to fails are still too big to fail, and we need to do something about it ASAP, which is pretty, a little bit surprising and somewhat encouraging, I guess, coming from even a Federal Reserve Bank. So.
Now, in Bozeman, we have had a couple people tell us, because of the information you've put out, we've taken our money out of Wells Fargo. And we've had people internal to the group who said, oh my gosh, I have an account here, I need to get it out. The question I have is, how can we, and it doesn't have to be Wells Fargo, but working on these issues, encourage each other to take actions? I mean, Josh is one person who, because of his background, what I want to emphasize is not just what he's doing, but the thought process that brings him there. Hey, I have knowledge about banking from what I read. I have a degree in economics. Here's an idea that I think can be worthwhile. I'm going to just do it and get involved and become, you know, the Montana point person for the Public Banking Institute. What are each of us, what keeps us from taking those steps, or what can we do to encourage each other to take steps, whether it's banking or some other related issue regarding our disempowerment in society, economic and otherwise. I just want to throw that out there.
Well, we'll put an article about it in our newsletter and spread that around. But, the health insurance industry has slowly changed where more and more organizations like the state are doing self-insuring, and now the governor has approved this new insurance health. Insurance thing that's
cooperative,
right? So the whole idea of getting smaller and more local is kind of gaining some traction, but it'll be slow. But at least we'll put something in our newsletter.
So are you aware of any kind of constituency in North Dakota that's opposed to or wanting to get rid of the bank, or has it been so successful that it's just popular there?
I've been, in listening to the North Dakota bankers talking about it on Friday on our conference call, nobody really brought that up. I would assume that the big multinationals would be more than happy to get rid of the bank in North Dakota. But when it comes to the local independent bankers, it was everybody was pretty much positive. They were all very positive about the Bank of North Dakota and were very clear that, that being able to partner with the Bank of North Dakota helps them compete with the large multinational banks and offer services they wouldn't otherwise be able to offer. They have, if not the highest, I think they have the highest like local banks per capita, kind of, they've got a very good, sound, local banking system there. So anybody trying to get rid of the bank, at this point, I think they'd have a really, really hard time doing that because it's been around for almost 100 years. It really has become part of the culture. The only people I can think of that would have a real interest in it would be people like Wells Fargo, Bank of America.
Seems like that could be a pretty good thing to know or get a handle on in terms of trying to get something, the argument being, hey, they have this in North Dakota and everybody loves it.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons we had this, organized this call with the North Dakota bankers. Was because with both the bills, in the last session, the arguments against tended to come mainly from local bankers who thought, this state public bank is going to compete with me, is going to take customers away. And that's just an education issue, because that's not at all what we're talking about, and that's not how the BND works. And so, you know, it's one thing if I'm saying it to some, you know, banker who's against this. It's a whole other thing if Eric Hardemeyer, the president of Bank of North Dakota, or, you know, the president of Alaris Bank in, you know, Grand Rapids or whatever, is telling them, you know, some town in North Dakota is saying, look, you know, this is good for us and this helped us compete, so.
Fargo.
Yeah.
I have a question, Josh.
Yeah.
How come we don't just use the local banks and credit unions that are in place instead of establishing yet another bank?
Well, because what a larger institution can do is provide services that are, you know, your local credit union or Rocky Mountain Bank or whatever can't provide, just because they're just not big enough, you know.
Services like what?
So, for instance, if there's a big development project, you know, or some, you know, industrial development or something, and you know, some developer or some businessman needs a loan that's $3 million, not going to be able to get that maybe from, you know, the local banks that just don't have the capacity to be able to provide those kind of large loans.
So I want to throw in one thing. One reason we shifted focus maybe from U.S. Bank to Wells Fargo was the question was raised, what is the alternative for Montana State University to move their funds from U.S. Bank? Can the credit unions in town actually handle that account? And there was a lot of doubt whether that was even possible. And so, obviously, there's another problem besides simple divestment.
I think it's just what Josh said, that credit unions are limited in the size of loans they can issue.
Right, and also even with local independent, you know, banks, those banks are their goal for that institution is to make a profit and to make as much, you know, as big a profit as they can reasonably make. And that's fine. I don't necessarily have any problem with that. But what having a state bank allows us as a society to do is say, okay, look, you know, we really think that, you know, our college students should be able to, you know, get loans to pay for their education and not have to pay 6%. You know, they can, you know, we want to be able to give them a very low interest loan. We want to support our agricultural sector. We want to support CSAs. My personal hope for this is that we have a loan program to support cooperative, worker-owned and managed businesses. So why having some kind of democratically controlled bank is a good idea, I think, is because then we can say, as a society, as a state, we can say, look, we want to support this particular type of development, we want to support this sector, and then, you know, we have the ability to offer, to make sure that credit and, you know, cash are available for those things, rather than just depending on the local banks. We're allowing the local banks to do this and still be able to make a profit.
Thinking to myself that I try to study every day, but I'm really ignorant on many of these issues. But one thing I don't know, maybe you've done some study on this, is just as in the campaign to divest from corporations that were funding South Africa, or now in Israel because of its occupation cruelties, and other kinds of divestment campaigns that are international, when churches got involved and universities got involved, you know, you have big bucks people. You know, I could take my money out of an organization that I find out is, you know, if I found out that my pension fund was going to Caterpillar or something like that, I could do something about that. But churches in Montana must have a lot of money somewhere. You know, there's a lot of churches. I don't know how much money they have. I'm not a member of any church, so I can't go to my local, I have been, but I'm no longer. But I can't go to my local governing board and say, hey, where's our money? Because I'm not giving any money to these churches. But I would think that the Catholic diocese of, you know, in Montana, or the Episcopal diocese, or local churches, or the Methodists in Montana, Wyoming, probably have a lot of money. And where do they keep their money? Anybody know, or has anybody studied that?
I can tell you one thing I know for sure is that the Unitarian Universalists have no money. They're broke across the state. That's a good point, and I think it's to what, you know, like Jim was saying, is that, you know, feeling like you can make a difference, and yeah, it's true that, like, if I go and, you know, take all my $300 out of, you know, away from Wells Fargo, like, ooh, big deal, like, they could care less. But if, you know, I or you or, you know, we go to, you know, the institutions and groups that we have some involvement with and start having the conversation there and saying, look, where is our church, you know, holding its money? Where, you know, where are we banking? And, you know, should we really be doing this? And make it an issue for, you know, to get some of these larger institutions that might actually have some, a little bit more sway and make a little bigger dent.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because as soon as you said it, I realized, oh, I will do that. The church that I do.
Right, because a church is not likely, an individual church is not likely to have an account so large that some other smaller institution couldn't handle it.
Right.
Where, you know, so there is something between MSU and the various places we work.
And my pocketbook.
Right. So, for sure. I mean, those are our points of leverage, and the more direct we can make those, the better we are going to be as a society, and the more hopefully these things do like this before we peter out, you know. And that's why it's so important to be taking action now, even if the odds seem astronomical sometimes.
So if you could get your divestment campaign to be perfectly effective for the goals that you're trying to achieve, what are those goals? Is it kill Wells Fargo? Yeah. Drive them out of existence? Shame them and make them corporate citizens?
Should I speak for myself? Because I know there's probably some disagreement. Because maybe Fern can talk afterwards. Because we had she's brought this up. She says, like, what are we trying to do? Are we trying to ride them out of business? Are we trying to change them? And personally, I would like to run them out of business. I mean, I don't see anything in that model where you have a shareholder model where people are taking their money and giving them to someone else that is conducive to a more economically just society. So in Bozeman, we can't run Wells Fargo completely out of business. This is just one branch. But if you can make some effect on the branch, right, then you've made a difference within your community. Then it's easier to go after U.S. Bank. It may even be easier to hold local banks accountable, which have often a collusive relationship with bigger banks, reselling loans to bigger banks. If that becomes an issue that matters, and if you can take Wells Fargo out, and that already seems like a big dream, then, hey, you know, suddenly you've got point where you really can tell other places around the country, you also can do this. There's no reason you can't. And hopefully that spreads like wildfire. But it's simultaneous with moving money into more locally controlled institutions, because we don't just want another depression from banks collapsing all around us. We want something stable in its place. And that's one reason I asked Josh to talk, you know, as talking about what are these transitional forms. Because ultimately, personally, I don't want to even just see a state bank. I would like to see us in our communities be able to take care of each other with, you know, grow our food, and, you know, I'm more of a hippie in that mind, you know, sustainability. But we can't just go from A to Z without some pieces in the middle, and that's what I think the state banking initiative, the public banking initiative through state banks represents. And I, before I guess,
okay.
You know, Fern.
I saw this on the Occupy statement, not verbatim, but a statement somebody made on the OccupyCafe.org site, I think it was. And they said, couldn't it be, we're not trying to take down the banks because they're too big and they're backed up by too much ignorance, which is this lack of knowledge. So if we were to what the guy said, this guy said, go ahead, you do what you're going to do, we're creating something different. And I think that's a more effective thing than trying to do this us against them thing. And I think it creates a better energy that keeps more people involved, because if we're working, say it's a divestment slash educate and support the state bank initiative, I think we'd have a lot more energy that would pull people in.
Let me just respond to that, because I think that's been a tension throughout the history of anyone who wanted to do a recreation of society. It sort of mimics what early socialists in the 19th century argued about, whether we can sort of create our society simply from the ground up and ignore the larger society, or those who say, no, we need to attack the larger society, and eventually things will also happen from the ground up. And personally, I take a sort of simultaneous view that we both have to be creating, but we have to be doing it in a way that's also hurting, that we, because if we don't, they're going to see what's happening and they're going to crush us or they're just going to let us go and we're not, because we're not effective. But more likely, if we're more effective doing this, they're not hurt and they're not feeling it, then they're going to not allow that to happen. So I think it has to be a simultaneous realizing we're part of a bigger society where other people are being hurt by this, and we have to attack those abuses at the same time that we build up a positive. That's my personal view on it. But others have taken the view that we just need to create and hopefully things will crumble from beneath, and that certainly could be right. I don't know.
Yeah, and I agree with you, though. It's kind of a two-pronged thing. But I think it's important that we consider the language we use and the energetics that we're creating through attack. And war is war is war. And so if we can engage in a different kind of... I mean, that's too woo-woo for everybody, but I know how it impacts my life and my communities. So I just want to say that. And it isn't about doing one thing over the other. It's about a two-pronged approach, but how do we approach it on the thought level?
Mm-hmm.
How do we hold it?
Yeah, we always had this in the anti-war movement. Are you anti-war or are you for peace? And I actually always felt more comfortable saying I was anti-war, because I was afraid whenever someone said they were for peace, they had a specific worldview of how they wanted peace to look like, where anti-war seemed to unite us. We knew what we were against and we'd be free to figure it out. So to me, anti-war was actually more positive, even though peace sounded more positive. And I think that's kind of where we're getting at. The language sometimes resonates differently with different people.
This move to bring a state bank to thinking, how feasible is it? I mean, what are our chances? Do you think it's, and also, how soon do you think this could happen? It's something that we should strive for in 5 years we might be able to...
Oh, no. I think the odds of us being able to do it are actually pretty good. It was encouraging in the last legislative session to see on both the banking bills that the support and opposition were both pretty bipartisan, which says, you know, to me, this isn't some left-right issue where, you know, it's a Democrat thing. We just got to, you know, get all the Democrats behind it. It really is something that, you know, appeals to a broad base of people. Obviously, it also, there's a lot of people voting against it on both sides.
Yeah, somebody from the Tea Party?
Yeah, Joe Reed, actually. I was kind of surprised to see he apparently had some pretty wacky bills that he also submitted, but that we had a progressive Democrat and a Tea Party Republican both, you know, kind of on the same page, basically on the same page with this. So I think there's that politically it is really viable. We're going to have legislation in the 2013 session, and there's no reason why, you know, can't be up and running within a year of that, you know, bill being passed. So it's definitely not something that's a pipe dream, and like I said, there are a number of other states that are looking at it quite seriously, but we could well be one of the first.
Has any thought been given to a referendum public?
Yeah, so the going through the initiative process is like if we fail in the legislature, I guess, is the thought right now, mostly because of the amount of resources it takes to organize an initiative campaign. So the MOPers think that it's probably better to try through the legislative process first. I'm willing to go along.
So is there an organizing, who's involved in this? There's already been a bill last time, so people have just been hearings and everything. I would think that, and I did, kind of wasn't on my radar last session, so ideally you're going to have people actually bring it up in the campaigns this summer and talk about it, so when it gets to the session, people are going to go, oh, you know, rather than coming brand new.
Oh, yeah.
January 1st, how is that going to happen?
So right now, Sheena Rice she's definitely kind of taking the lead on a lot of the organizing. She's with the Montana Organizing Project, MOP, and she's, her and Molly Moody, Sheena's in Billings, and Molly's in Missoula, and they've been and then myself and Bozeman, and so we've been doing, and Sheena mostly has been doing outreach to legislators on the banking committee, or whatever appropriate committee that is, and talking to candidates. There's been some discussions with Dick Barrett, I believe. I don't even know if he's still. Yeah. Dick was was an econ professor at U of M, and then he was in the legislature. I don't know if he still is this next session or not. But so that's, I guess that the candidate education is kind of starting right now and ongoing, and definitely like to try to make it an issue. And trying to do some education with the decision makers before we get too far along here in the process.
You said the Bank of North Dakota has been around since like
1918.
So I'm just thinking, why is it, I mean, I'm glad this is happening, it's great, but why has it taken this long for other states to kind of want to emulate that? Or maybe it hasn't taken this long and there's been efforts in the past and we're just...
Yeah, I mean, and this is a good question, one that I've gotten a number of times and don't really have a good answer to, like, why has anybody done this sooner? And as far as I know, the first real effort at all was in this last session in Montana. I don't know of bills. There may well have been before that.
Actually, there were back in the 70s when the subdivision thing was taken on, we were looking at getting money to farmers. We're looking at the North Dakota model, and then got talked. I'm not even sure. I think there were bills, but didn't get very.
Right.
It got debated. I think it was around 74, 75.
So there you go. I mean, 5 years before I was born, somebody was talking about it. but yeah, I think. What makes it relevant now, or maybe it seems more relevant, is because of the financial crisis that we've been going through and that's ongoing in this country, and just the kind of realization that the big banks that we thought were rock solid are really not at all. And I think that, you know, the whole bailout fiasco has definitely kind of pushed people to look at a little bit more, and because, you know, like I said, there was the credit crisis, the credit crunch in 2008, I mean, that had serious effects. I was painting houses in Missoula, and I remember, like, there was a morning that we got to work, and it was like, we just lost two jobs last night, and, like, this other contractor we're working with, he, like, lost a couple jobs, and it was, you know, the credit dried up, and all of a sudden, there was work that just wasn't there because it was dependent on people getting loans that were no longer available just all of a sudden overnight. And so, I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, saw that and was like, whoa, that was not fun. That was not a good thing. And the reason it happened is because, you know, the national system has got some pretty serious flaws in it. And so trying to make sure that we have control over our own credit system is looking more important.
I was just thinking, one of you mentioned the mortgage crisis and the and the pension funds being invested in mortgage-backed securities and other institutional investors being invested in those. And as they all these mortgages fail, it seems like those institutional investors and pension funds should be able to sue the banks. And if they can sue the banks, that should put the banks out of business. But I don't know if this agreement with the Attorney General's where the major banks only had to contribute $25 billion or whatever it was, if that protects them from suits from all these institutional investors. I haven't got that figured out.
I don't think it does.
I don't think it did. I think they kept that door open.
Yeah.
I know some people are really worried about.
There have been some questions. I don't know. I've been following it on the Naked Capitalism blog, which is pretty good financial, really good financial blog. It seems like there are still questions as to what exactly the release that the banks got was. And the promise was it was going to be a very narrow release and that they would still be open to lawsuits on a lot of other fronts. And I hope that's what actually came through. It looks like that might be the case. I just saw there were in New York, I think Schneiderman is filing suits against a number of the banks and the MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration System, for illegally avoiding all of the title transfer taxes. And I think there are definitely going to be more and more lawsuits coming. And as this whole thing kind of plays out and the investors and the pension funds figure out, like, hey, we're getting screwed, like the banks are getting credit for writing down loans that we own. How does that work? I think there might, be some more lawsuits coming. We can almost hope.
I just had another thought about how ignorance plays into this, because you say, I would say, if you talk to people about what happened in September 2008 and why it happened, you get various theories about what that is. And something bad happened, but I think you get level of ignorance. Just people don't know what happened and why it happened. And Wells Fargo's role in it, or Bank of America's role in it, or the system that led to the selling of these derivatives, and so forth. That people would say, I know it's something bad, but what exactly happened, Because I would say, you talk to people, and it takes a lot of time to study and figure these things out. I talked to a fellow just before who couldn't come to today, but I mentioned where I was going. He said, yeah, I've taken my money out of Wells Fargo. And he knew why he was doing that. But I also talked to a person I thought was usually very well, extremely knowledgeable, former representative from the Helena area, who didn't know anything about Wells Fargo. He'd just gotten a mortgage from Wells Fargo. And I mentioned a few of the things as I, studying Jim's materials and materials there. He that didn't come on his radar at all. So an otherwise very diligent person who's up on all kinds of things was as dumb as anybody in terms of ignorance the basement, knew nothing about this. You better look into this.
So many of my friends at Buffalo Field Campaign discovered, hey, a lot of us have our accounts at Wells Fargo. We're only in West Yellowstone a few months of the year. It's convenient, the branches, I don't want to have to keep finding a new bank, but totally ignorant or willfully ignorant that it's actually costing them more money to do things that way than even from purely selfish motives, it doesn't make sense. But it seems to, because there's a sort of convenience about it. And people who are right on one issue, who understand the social impact of not having Buffalo in the news this week with quarantine Buffalo being transferred to Fort Peck, understand the relationship of Buffalo to American history and indigenous peoples, very important ideas to understand America and American history, have no concept of the banking industry and capitalism and all of that. And so bridging these things between, like you said, thoughtful people But making the connections between one thing and another is really difficult.
Does that turn Occupy into an educational campaign? Seems like that's the need.
Yeah. I think a large part of it is, I mean, I know in Missoula, that was one of the very first things that the encampment decided was, we all have a lot of questions that we don't have answers to, and we need to educate ourselves. And so, you know, setting up the teach-in groups or whatever was one of the very first things they did. And a lot of this, I think, just is education. My girlfriend, for instance, she's doing a PhD in chemistry at the university there, and hanging out with her, you know, other grad student buddies, and they're all, you know, very well educated and fairly progressive, a lot of them, and, you know, talk to them about the Wells Fargo thing, and just have no idea. It's, you know, like, oh, they're not a good company. It's like, well, if you're looking, if you're actually paying attention, it's like, wow, these guys have been engaged in some criminal activity for a long time, and it looks like they're still doing it. And in a lot of other situations, you might, you know, if it was some guy down the street that you'd been doing business with and all this stuff came out about him, you'd probably stop, but
okay, it's just convenient. So here's the big problem that I have. All of the banks are worthless. The Fed is the problem, and it continues to print money based on my grandchildren's taxes. And that whole system is flawed. So what's the value in taking my money out of one big bank and putting it into one little bank at all?
Well, regardless of what we might think about how our system, our macroeconomic system works, and, you know, the whole issue of fiat currencies versus some kind of commodity-backed currency, or should we have a gold standard, or, you know, what should be going on? Like, we can think whatever we want about that. The facts of the matter as they are right now is that, you know, we have these little pieces of paper, and they're pretty important, and we can give them to this huge, massive institution and have absolutely no say over what they do with them, okay. Or we can put them in a little institution that at least we conceivably can have some say or more say. Right, yeah. It's not like, and that's the thing, is like this, the state banking, in my mind, this isn't like, this is going to solve all of our problems and make the economy great and just and yada yada. It's like, no, not at all. It's just moving in a better direction and kind of decentralizing our banking system a little bit. One of the things that the Bank of North Dakota does is it acts like a little federal reserve for the state of North Dakota, and that's, I think, a pretty good thing and handy for those banks in North Dakota. Yeah.
Did you say North Dakota has more community banks than anywhere else? So
yeah.
State bank isn't where you would move your money to. That's
not no, you just move it to a local bank.
It's not changing. Maybe a state bank would alert people to support the community banks more, and so the big banks would not have to make deposits.
Right, well, it definitely allows the independent and the local banks to compete with the big banks a lot easier and offer more services to their customers. And
I think it also makes an argument, and obviously this becomes a major topic that has a chance to pass, people are going to, you know, come unglued and you say, well, actually, for a Main Street business, the local banks in North Dakota like this. It's actually an argument that's going to get a lot of people in favor of it that may not totally buy into everything. Still move a long way towards putting up with, you know, more of a bridge between local economies and local banks versus the big banks. So, even though these other issues aren't solved, it seems like this makes sense.
Yep.
In some concrete way.
I think Gary's question and your question, frankly, are most valuable so far. The question of what are you trying to accomplish? And another historical model comes out of Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement, where in trying to make the sit-ins work, he suggested bank-ins. Mm-hmm. And he was very specific about saying, take your money out of, to the black community in particular, take your money out of the downtown banks, that's what he called them at that time, mm-hmm. and put them in the outliers of the smaller community banks. I think it's a powerful model in service of a higher goal, mm-hmm.
which tends to answer the question that you're pondering at, and really answers, you know, where are we going in a positive way?
Mm-hmm. And I think that works, but it worked for the civil rights movement and people who were directly affected, because they saw that the black community was being screwed by the downtown banks owned by the whites.
I think they had to be convinced.
But they once they began to see the connection, immediately they were being hurt. They were being hurt dramatically. And the economic boycotts sometimes were an important part of that. But for most people, including, you know, like this one otherwise very knowledgeable person, I can remember, I talk to people as much as I can. There's one person who was, I'd probably say, was one of the most knowledgeable students I ever met on global justice issues and this and that, who, when he saw the film Inside Job, said, Jesus, but I did not know about what went down that day and the bank's role in that. And I want everybody to see that movie. But, and he, you know, here's a guy who studies all the time. I know this young man. He studies every day, and he's been doing that for, you know, 15 years. But most people don't study every day. And they, if they watch some news, they might happen to watch Fox News, where you won't learn anything about these things. People make fun of Occupy Helena, make fun of whoever it is that's complaining about the system. Because, so education is just tremendous in this. I just reinforce that point. But then the model would be, if you have the AT&T system, awareness, truths, and transformations, once you become aware that you shouldn't have your money, and there's no good reason to have your money in Wells Fargo or Bank of America, then you take it out. Why do you stay there? Convenience is no excuse. I mean, if you have an otherwise progressive person who says, inconvenient because I want to keep my money there, just say, you know, busy, busy, busy. What are you busy about? Take your money out and just confront them with that. I mean, it's not a matter of making them feel guilty, but saying, you know, hey, that's no excuse. And you got to, it's one by one to get us out of this system. I'm not sure how many people will have to do, but Bob Holmes used to say one by one by one by one makes a million. And very many.
And Occupy Oakland against Wells Fargo ended up taking their money out and the next Monday putting it back in because they didn't have another bank to put it in.
Is it really what happened?
But then they got it out.
Ultimately. But the challenge is before us, right. And we're entrenched in this mechanism.
I just want to say, we have to get out of this room at 5 o'clock so the library staff don't have to work overtime.
Can we keep talking,
but let's also realize we've got 2 minutes to leave.
Just historically, when did the banks become too big to fail, or are they always pretty much too big to fail?
I would think that probably, so there was the SNL, like debacle in the 80s, and a lot of banks failed I think the first kind of stealth bailout we did was in the early 90s of some investment funds or long-term capital management. That was the one big hedge fund I remember that they went tits up, and a lot of their investors got bailed out. There was some it really within the last, you know, since 90 probably, last 20 years or so.
Of course, before banking regulations in the 30s, this used to happen also fairly regularly in history. England, Barclays, there'd be this, there'd bank failures that happen every 7 years, and there'd be inevitably an argument whether banks should be bailed out, whether the whole system would fail. But then things got stable. So maybe one answer to why there hasn't been a Bank of North Dakota discussion is we had a remarkable era of banking stability, unlike any in the history of banking over several decades.
And during the Clinton administration, we started rolling back things like the Glass-Steagall Act, and I mean that added to it immensely because all of a sudden you had Travelers Group and Citicorp, like, you know, all of a sudden that's twice as big as any company ever used to be, so.
Yeah, that's the point I was using, whatever, lawyers and stuff, it's when Bill Clinton signed off, Bill, which is part of the last one, and then we kind of started really to.
But they already, there already been some bailouts before that. I can't remember what I was looking at, but it kind of seemed like it was kind of this building process, kind of in earnest, you know, one little thing. Old smaller company fails and gets bailed out, and that's kind of the signal to other people that, oh, we'll probably get bailed out if we fail too. So let's all of a sudden do this really, really risky stuff.
Well, I want to thank Jim and Josh and everybody.
Yeah.